It is Thursday, December 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the first Aleppo evacuees leave the rebel-held area of the Syrian city. Egyptian officials say traces of explosives were found on victims of the Egypt Air flight crash last May. And the classic Nutcracker Ballet gets a new look in Chicago. It's all ahead. Ambulances and government buses began evacuating wounded and other civilians from the last rebel-held areas of Aleppo Thursday after evacuation attempts were halted a day earlier. The long line of buses and ambulances headed out of besieged eastern Aleppo and into government-held territory before eventually making it to another rebel-held part of the province. I spoke with Anna Nelson, chief spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in the United States and Canada, about the operation.
Well, yeah, the evacuation started actually around 1 a.m. Washington time this morning, and a few hours later, 10 Syrian Arab Red Crescent ambulances were able to cross through. So far, what I'm hearing from my colleagues on the ground is that around 26 wounded and nearly 1,000 others, the majority of them civilian, have been evacuated and are being transferred to western rural Aleppo. And I'm getting word that the second phase of the evacuation is now underway.
And what will that second phase be?
My understanding is that the International Committee of the Red Cross staff and the Syrian Arab Red Crescent volunteers that are on the ground, there's about 100 volunteers and about a dozen ICRC staff, are hoping to evacuate 200 to 250 wounded and sick. Exact numbers are hard to confirm. We're also evaluating what the situation with the healthcare structures are like. What I had heard from our colleagues is that, frankly, they've never seen such levels of suffering and destruction before. And this is coming from people who have been in the field for a very long time and who have seen have been witness to conflicts in many places. So that's quite something.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there enough medical care there at the moment? You know, on the ground, are there enough, say, doctors and nurses being able to help with this evacuation?
And my understanding is that there were about 20 buses involved, again, around 100 volunteers and a dozen ICRC staff. I think, you know, because we hadn't had access to the area, it was hard to know exactly what the needs were. So that's what they're in the process of evaluating and clearly making those wounded and sick patients the priority. So I think it's going to be a question of time. But what we do know is that, you know, fuel has been running short for quite a while now. It's cold. It's the middle of winter there. You know, the healthcare situation, you know, we assume is essentially non-existent in the east. We know that there were only two health structures partially working without medicine and very limited capacity. So I think we can assume that what existed inside eastern Aleppo was very alarming by means of medical services. And now, the priority will be to get the sick and wounded out.
And where will they be going?
So they're being taken to western rural Aleppo near and to Idlib province by bus and by ambulance.
That's Anna Nelson, chief spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross in the United States and Canada. Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, we're continuing to see people in Aleppo sharing their stories on social media, and we're continuing to monitor that as people send in those videos. And we'll continue to share that with our listeners as those stories develop and as we see those stories take shape on social media. Here in the U.S. today, we have a couple of trending stories all related to U.S. government. The first is a report from some senior intelligence officials who say that Vladimir Putin was involved with the hack on the Democratic National Committee that many say influenced the election. So that's getting a lot of discussion on social media, including from President-elect Donald Trump, who tweeted out and asked, why there's such an attention on this now, why there wasn't attention on this prior. That's being countered with people saying, well, there was attention on this. It's just it's been a developing story as more information's come out. We're also seeing the hashtag esteemed electors. Now, this was something we talked about previously, people trying to convince members of the Electoral College to not vote for Donald Trump and support the popular vote, which had Hillary Clinton ahead. And ahead of the December 19th Electoral College vote, we're seeing this hashtag esteemed electors, where people are pleading with them and imploring them not to vote for Donald Trump, or at least wait and consider the facts, including that hacking. So we'll see on Monday what comes of that, if there are any other campaigns that develop before that vote. And then finally, today in the U.S. is the 225th anniversary of the Bill of Rights. So today is hashtag Bill of Rights Day. So we have lots of people celebrating in the U.S. the freedoms afforded to them in the Bill of Rights. And depending on your place in the political spectrum, that could mean praising the First Amendment, which is freedom of speech, praising the Second Amendment, which is the right to bear arms, so a lot of gun owners, or the Fourth Amendment, which is the protection against illegal search and seizure. So people kind of picking and choosing which ones they want to celebrate on this Bill of Rights Day.
At least there's something to celebrate.
And at least there's something to celebrate. That is very true.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. President-elect Donald Trump complains about attempts to undermine his election. Ukraine will release 15 prisoners in a goodwill gesture to pro-Russian rebels. A blast from an IED kills six soldiers in Mogadishu. And the Paris train attack suspect says his orders came from the Islamic State. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A recent assessment by the UN's World Meteorological Organization indicates that 2016 will likely be the hottest year on record. Some scientists have suggested that injecting light-reflecting sulfate aerosols into the stratosphere might cool the planet. The problem with this approach is that while sulfate aerosols could cool the world down, a nasty side effect would be that doing so would produce sulfuric acid in the atmosphere. This is something scientists say would damage the ozone layer, which in itself could lead to a variety of health problems for Earth's living creatures. Now, Harvard researchers say that they've found using calcite, a component of limestone, rather than sulfate, might be able to cool the planet while at the same time repair any ozone damage. But both ideas reside only in the halls of academia. For now, no such global climate control plans are actually underway. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, President-elect Donald Trump, some people believe, needs to separate himself from a Department of Justice investigation. Egypt's Civil Aviation Ministry said Thursday traces of explosives were found on some of the victims of the Egypt Air crash in May. According to a ministry statement, state prosecutors are expected to take over the investigation into the Egypt Air Flight 804 crash that killed 66 people. I spoke to Sajan Goel, International Security Director for the London-based Asia-Pacific Foundation.
Well, the mystery of the Egypt airplane crash still continues. There's always been suspicion that it was terrorism. Recent evidence now uncovered suggests that that is now a possibility, but we still require more information to come out, and one unfortunately still remains dependent on the Egyptian authorities to provide that. In the past, they have shown reluctance to talk about terrorism targeting their planes and their aviation industry, just like with the Metrojet bombing from the Sinai. Egypt was initially reluctant to mention it was terrorism. This incident with the Egypt airplane has dragged on for longer than one was hoping. But it is important to find a clarity as to what happened in order to understand what security lapses there may have been.
Yeah, this plane took off from Paris. I believe it left from the Charles de Gaulle airport. Certainly, I mean, as the investigation continues, there will be a lot of looking at what went on there. But the fact that this plane left from Paris, and if it does turn out to be terrorism, certainly there are some real security problems at that airport.
Coupled with the fact that you have the Egyptian authorities always downplaying the potential threat of terrorism, there is this added concern as to what security lapse there may have been at Paris's Charles de Gaulle airport when the Egypt airplane took off. Now, that is a major worry because we're not talking about some airport in the developing world. We're talking about one of the Western world's most busiest airports and one which is supposed to have very good security. If there is a failing there, if there is some weakness that the terrorists have exploited, it is potentially possible that it could then happen again. What, of course, needs to also be looked at is to why, as of yet, no one has formally taken credit for the bombing, alleged bombing off the Egypt airplane crash, if it is terrorism.
Yeah, that is interesting. You know, the fact that no group, no organization has claimed responsibility for this, at least yet.
Well, and this is what has created more of the mystery about the Egypt airplane crash, because no one has taken any credit if it was terrorism, whereas in the case of the Metrojet bombing, even though the Egyptian authorities downplayed terrorism, the ISIS affiliate in the region, Wiliat Sinai, took credit very quickly and provided some evidence of it. In this case, no one has done it. Now, you could argue that it's possible the terrorists don't want to divulge who did it because they potentially want to do it. Equally, it could be that the terrorists themselves are unsure whether publicizing the incident is beneficial or not. So there are a lot of question marks that still remain. We sort of inch forward to finding the full answer, but it is very slow progress.
That's Sajan Gohel, International Security Director for the Asia-Pacific Foundation in London. Well, this week, President-elect Donald Trump postponed a highly anticipated announcement on how he'll deal with conflicts between his global businesses and his job as president. His financial investments are one concern, but his debts are another, including loans held by a German bank. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti looks at one big one, the U.S. Department of Justice investigations into his biggest lender, Germany's Deutsche Bank.
They are stately properties with prime addresses. Golf resorts, skyscrapers, all carry high mortgages for President-elect Donald Trump. These three properties are of particular concern to experts because of the bank that holds the loan. $364 million from Germany's Deutsche Bank. Former White House ethics attorney Richard Painter.
The question is whether the president should be indebted to large banks while he is supervising the people who are going to work out our posture toward bank regulation and also enforcement of the rules we already have, including the pending actions against Deutsche Bank.
One pending action is a U.S. Department of Justice investigation into Deutsche Bank's improper selling of mortgage securities before the 2008 financial crisis. Jan Baron, an expert on political law, says a conflict could be avoided if managed properly.
Cases over at the Department of Justice are handled by career professional prosecutors and attorneys who work at the Department of Justice, no matter who the president is. And there is no reason for any president to be involved in the matter.
Financial experts tell VOA total divestiture is nearly impossible. And it is also unclear how Trump might insulate himself from U.S. government actions involving Deutsche Bank. The Trump transition team declined to answer VOA's questions. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. and our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. This is the season when ballet companies all over the U.S. present The Nutcracker by Tchaikovsky. The holiday classic tells the story of a young girl whose favorite Christmas gift, a nutcracker, comes alive and whisks her away to a magical kingdom populated by dolls. The original story takes place in Germany, but some companies give it a different spin. Here in the nation's capital, the Washington Ballet sets the production in Georgetown, with President George Washington as the Nutcracker. This year, Chicago's Joffrey Ballet is looking to that city's immigrant history for inspiration. Jeff London reports.
If this music by Tchaikovsky gives you visions of sugar plum fairies, you are not alone. For many ballet fans, and practically every ballet dancer, the Nutcracker is their gateway. Christopher Wheeldon danced his first Nutcracker when he was 11 with London's Royal Ballet.
And I was selected to be one of the kids in that production. And then I, you know, continued dancing in the Nutcracker for my years as a dancer, especially moving to America.
Wheeldon is now a choreographer and has created a new Nutcracker for the Joffrey Ballet. While he happily accepted the assignment, he had some questions.
You know, if I'm going to approach a classic like the Nutcracker, how can I put my stamp on it? You know, why is it worthwhile to look at this?
The key for him was setting the new production in Chicago, specifically at the famous World's Fair of 1893, a period that is contemporaneous with the original ballet. He did a great deal of research.
One photograph in particular of a worker's shack sitting under the towering skeletal sort of construction of the buildings going up. And that sort of made us think about, oh, well, perhaps this is maybe the story of an immigrant worker's family rather than, you know, the child of a wealthy Victorian family.
So Wheeldon's Nutcracker, with a new scenario by children's book author Brian Selznick, focuses on Polish immigrants.
The largest innovation in this production is its setting, is the idea that it's a poor family, that it focuses on a community that sort of comes together at Christmas and very much makes do with what it has.
The cast includes 50 professional dancers and more than 100 kids. Principal ballerina Victoria Giani danced her first Nutcracker in Tbilisi, Georgia, when she was 11. She's been with the Joffrey Company for 14 years and danced many roles in the Nutcracker, including the Sugar Plum Fairy. This year, she is doing the equivalent part, but says Wheeldon has added psychological dimension.
Here, we have a chance to build a story. It has a bit more depth, in my perspective, and meaning. So the first act, I play the sculptress, also a single parent to Marie and Fritz. She is sculpting one of the biggest sculptures of the World's Fair in Chicago. And then in the second act, in Marie's imagination, it's in her dream that her mom becomes a golden statue herself.
And the World's Fair setting seems a natural fit for the second act, when the magical Drosselmeyer character, here named the Impresario, takes Marie on a tour of the fair.
It seemed like a no-brainer in a way, because the the international pavilions at the World's Fair are kind of the perfect setting for the sort of standard national dances of the second act.
Mm-hmm. Wieldon says despite the fresh take, he's making sure his production delivers what is expected of a Nutcracker.
We follow the structure of the story quite closely and the things that are dictated by the score, like the Christmas tree growing, the land of the snow, the waltz of the snowflakes. All of those are still very much in this production.
The Joffrey Ballet plans to present Wieldon's production every year and take it on tour, so audiences outside Chicago can experience it as well. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in Chicago.
A new approach to an old classic. Well, in medical news, research released this week says nearly 6% of pregnant American women infected with the Zika virus delivered babies with a birth defect. The rate was nearly twice as high for women infected early in the pregnancy. The results came from the first published research by the U.S. Zika Pregnancy Registry, a collaboration between the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and state and local health departments. It also showed that the rate of birth defects was the same, whether or not women showed any signs of infection during their pregnancy. Margaret Honan of the CDC says that's important because most people who get infected have no symptoms. However, symptoms include fever, rash, joint pain, and red eyes. Well, that is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the recent Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or OSCE, ministerial meeting, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry reaffirmed that we advance the security and prosperity of our citizens when we advance the timeless principles that are at the heart of the OSCE. These principles include democratic governance and the rule of law, anti-corruption, respect for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of every state, the dignity of each individual, and an unflinching stand against anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim, anti-Christian bigotry and intolerance of any kind. The ongoing conflict in eastern Ukraine and Russian occupation of Crimea are of particular concern. It is in the interest of all to end the suffering and the stalemate, and that is why the United States continues to support France and Germany in their efforts as mediators within the Normandy format. The United States strongly backs the trilateral contact group of the OSCE, Ukraine, and Russia, and renews its call for the full implementation of the Minsk agreements. At the same time, Russia's ongoing aggression in eastern Ukraine and occupation of Crimea must not obscure the longer-term challenge that Ukraine is tackling, the task of building a healthy democracy. And the fight against corruption and for reform is what the people of Ukraine rightly recognize as the decisive battlefield. Their determination to live in a democratic society governed by the rule of law, said Secretary Kerry, demands our support. There are other conflicts in the OSCE that still fester, including between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and in Moldova and Georgia. In too many places in the OSCE region, there has been a rise of authoritarian thinking accompanied by backsliding on human rights, restrictions on independent media, a spike in acts of intolerance and hate crimes. Bigotry, repression, and the silencing of dissent cannot become the new normal for any of us, said Secretary Kerry. Every chip away at the fundamentals of freedom is actually an ugly building block in the road to tyranny. A free press, religious liberty, political openness, transparency in governance, and a flourishing civil society are the signs of a thriving nation. When people and institutions are denied these rights, the OSCE will continue to speak out.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.